Right? Atacharya sitastesham. Atacharya sitastesham. Budime kanta samstitam. Budime kanta samstitam. Alakshabita svarito. Alakshabita svarito. Ragya vedayajata. Ragya vedayajata. Atacharya sitastesham. Budime kanta samstitam. Alakshabita svarito. Ragya vedayajata. Atacharya sitastesham. Budime kanta samstitam. Alakshabita svarito. Ragya vedayajata. Atacharya sitastesham. Budime kanta samstitam. Alakshabita svarito. Ragya vedayajata. Ladies. Sitastesham. Lakshabita svarito. Ragya vedayajata. Yanya sitastesham. Svarito. Alakshabita svarito. Ragya vedayajata. Ata, thereupon, Acharya Sutta, the son of Sukracharya, Tesham, of them, the sons of the demons, Budim, the intelligence, Ekanta, Samstitam, fixed in one subject matter, devotional service. Alaksha, realizing or seeing practically. Bita, being afraid. Varita, as soon as possible. Ragye, unto the king, Hiranyakashipu. Avedayat, submitted. Yata, fittingly. Translation. Please repeat. When Sunda and Amarka, the sons of Sukra Acharya, observed that all the students, the sons of the demons, were becoming advanced in Krishna consciousness, because of the association of Prahlad Maharaj, they were afraid. They approached the king of the demons and described the situation as it was. When Sunda and Amarka, the sons of Sukracharya, observed that all the students, the sons of the demons, were becoming advanced in Krishna consciousness because of the association of Prahlad Maharaj, they were afraid. They approached the king of the demons and described the situation as it was. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The words Buddhim Ekanta Samsitam indicate that as an effect of Prahlad Maharaj's preaching, the students who listened to him became fixed in the conclusion that Krishna consciousness is the only object of human life. The fact is that anyone who associates with a pure devotee and follows his instructions becomes fixed in Krishna consciousness and is not disturbed by materialistic consciousness. The teachers particularly observed this in their students, and therefore they were afraid because the whole community of students was gradually becoming Krishna conscious. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Srinivadi Paskachudeshitani Om Aganat Marandasha Ganagana Salakaya Chaksuan Militamyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. One time I was, I think the last time I gave class, I mentioned that the New Vrindavan Bhagavad Dharma Festival in 1972, where some people in this audience who prefer to remain anonymous and silent were there also, but did not speak up the last time I mentioned that festival, although they were there, Satyanarayan. But he didn't want to say anything about that, of course. But yeah, right. I was actually after I asked for comments from the devotees. But anyway, after that festival, Prabhupada went to Pittsburgh. You remember that? Everybody went to Pittsburgh, and at that time we had a road show with Tamal Krishna and Vishnu John, and they put on a play, The Age of Kali. The Kali play. It was a very famous play. And so they rented out the Shrine Auditorium, and they put on this play, and Prabhupada was in the audience, and several hundred people were there. And during Prabhupada's visit to Pittsburgh, one day I was wandering around the Pittsburgh Temple. It was this big three-story building in a very nice part of town. And I think Prabhupada was staying up on the third floor. And so one day I was just wandering around on the third floor, and Prabhupada was in his room by himself with a couple of reporters were there. So I walked in and I sat down, and I don't remember everything, obviously, in the Kali Yuga. Memories are very short, and mine is getting shorter with the time factor working upon me relentlessly. But I do remember that one of the reporters asked Prabhupada, "Do you really think that you can take over the world? Do you really think that your movement is going to take over the world?" And Prabhupada just very, as a matter of factly said, "Yes, if they will only listen to me." And there's so much meaning and so much content or substance in that very simple response, "if they will only listen to me." So that's actually what's going on here in this part of the Bhagavatam, is that by the association of Prahlad Maharaj, preaching to his classmates, the sons of demons, and they're listening to him. They're actually hearing what he had to say. They were actually becoming Krishna conscious because of this hearing and chanting, this process of preaching fearlessly. And that's really what this whole section of the Bhagavatam, the story of Hiranyakashipu, is all about. I mean, sometimes we have a tendency, I know in myself at least, over the years, in the old days, which is another phrase that old people use quite a bit, old days, every Sunday we would put on a feast at the Sunday feast. There would be, there'd be a play. Obviously there was a feast, but we'd put on a play. And frequently the story of Hiranyakashipu, certainly on Lord Nisringadev's appearance day, this play would be put on. And many times it was the Gurukula kids, the Gurukulis, the children that would put on these plays. And so all the parents would be in the audience, and we'd see our kids in these plays. And there was a tendency, to minimize or not really fully appreciate the magnitude or the severity of the situation in which Prahlad Maharaj was in relationship to his father, the king of the demons, the biggest demon of all. So we sometimes really don't appreciate, because we're exposed to it so much, and sometimes not the most serious or the most grave of situations, to understand what a dangerous situation Prahlad Maharaj was actually in. Now, one time I do have to admit, I played Hiranyakashipu in a play. And for the guts of Hiranyakashipu, we had this spaghetti, a lot of marinara sauce. And so when I, there was this one devotee, Jivadwar, I think his name was, and when I put him on my lap and pulled out the spaghetti and held it up and I screamed, nobody laughed. As a matter of fact, all the little kids started crying. So so last time I played that part, I didn't want to get sued for infliction of emotional distress or something like that. But we do have a tendency to not really appreciate how grave the danger that Prahlad Maharaj faced as a five-year-old child. Only 5 years old, as Voss was mentioning yesterday. He was only 5 years old. He was a little child. And his father was the biggest demon, had conquered the entire universe. Just to give you a little bit of insight, or by way of comparison to Hiranyakashipu, he was far greater than any demon that we've ever even heard about in our lifetime on this planet. And we've seen some pretty big demons. Hitler, Stalin, they would just murder anybody that even looked cross-eyed at them. They would murder them. Or he would murder anybody that was opposed to them. During the Battle of Stalingrad in World War II, the Russians were so ruthless that when they would send their soldiers to attack the German positions, they would leave a couple of machine gun nests in the rear of the battle formation. Because if any soldier, even no matter how much of a massacre it may have been, if they turned around and tried to come back and take shelter of their fortifications, the Russians would mow down their own soldiers with these machine guns. That's how ruthless they were. There's a story of the first emperor of China. His name was Qin. I don't know his whole name, but his dynasty, it was called the Qin Dynasty. And, of course, he was the first emperor who actually united all the provinces of China. There were like five or six of these different competitive or adversarial provinces, and they were all little empires unto themselves, and always fighting with each other. And this Qin, he conquered all of the various provinces. And from his name, Qin, comes, of course, China. That's where the name China comes from. But it's described how ruthless he was in order to accomplish that. He murdered every single member of his own family. Anybody that could even possibly was a threat to his being the emperor, he murdered them. He had two little children. They were like 5 and 7 or 8 or 9 years old. He even murdered them. He murdered his wife. He murdered his brothers. He murdered his sisters. Everybody in his entire family, what to speak of his political enemies. This guy was so crazy. He was so fearful that he had murdered so many people that he was afraid in the afterlife all his enemies were going to get their revenge on him. So he had this army made out of this substance. I can't remember what the substance was. What's that?
Terracotta.
Exactly. And thousands and thousands of these terracotta soldiers. Thousands. And just imagine how much work this entailed. And had them buried so that in the spirit world or in the afterlife, he could call upon these soldiers to protect him. And then he started, one of his advisors told him to drink mercury, that this would give him some kind of supernatural power or something. Actually, it ended up poisoning him. He died of mercury poisoning. But he was so ruthless. He was so ruthless that he went to, spared no expense to conquer his enemies, to preserve his position of power, and to defeat anybody that was a threat to his sense gratification. Even in France, during the French Revolution, the history of France is replete with all this intrigue and assassinations. I saw this one movie one time about this one king, and he was one of the brothers, and the mother favored another one of the brothers, and the sister favored somebody else. And so all these brothers were competing for the throne, and literally at one part of the movie, they're all wandering around the palace, and there's literally an assassin behind around every corner. There's some assassin for some one of the brothers waiting to assassinate their rivals. And this is common, how they, these leaders, these kings, would just murder anybody that could possibly, even if they were illegitimate or whatever they may be, they would murder them because they were a threat to their position of power, of ruling. So Prahlad Maharaj, imagine with these modern demons, Hiranyakashipu, how powerful he was. So the teachers were petrified when the class started to become Krishna conscious. They were petrified. Oh, if we go tell Hiranyakashipu that all of these children are becoming devotees of Krishna, Hiranyakashipu, of course, being envious of Krishna, thinking himself greater than Krishna, thinking himself more powerful than Krishna, he's going to kill them on the spot. They didn't want to go. They were petrified. And they, of course, they tried to stop Prahlad in every way they could think of. So in the next verse, we see that they go and they tell Hiranyakashipu what Prahlad is doing. And what is Hiranyakashipu's response? I'm going to kill him. I'm not going to put him in the corner. It's not a timeout. Go to the corner, go to your room, or you get no dinner tonight, or I'm going to even give you a spanking. He was going to murder him in cold blood, murder his own five-year-old child. That's Hiranyakashipu. At the same time, Prahlad was fearless because he had been instructed and had full faith in his spiritual master, Narada Muni, who ironically, as a five-year-old child, set out upon the world when his mother was bitten by a snake and traveled through all these dangerous places because they had full faith in the Lord. They had full faith that Krishna would protect them. So I was actually thinking about this verse somewhat, and for some reason, as I was thinking about it, Prabhupada's voyage to America kept popping up in my mind when Prabhupada left India and came to America. And I couldn't figure out why that portion of Prabhupada's pastimes connected to this story of Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu. And then I went back and I read the two poems that Prabhupada wrote, one while he was on the ship and another when he arrived in Boston. And I read them, and I could understand after reading these poems that there was actually a connection, that Prabhupada actually came to this country in the mood of Prahlad Maharaj. And I may get in trouble for saying this, but I do think that someday in the future, when the history books are finalized, the history books are not finished yet, and right now there are 12 Mahajans that we know of, I firmly believe that Srila Prabhupada is going to be added to that list as a Mahajan, because what he did in coming to this country was unprecedented. It's astonishing the more you think about it. And so what I'd like to do is read those poems, actually, because I think that they give us a lot of insight into Prabhupada's mood and his full surrender, because we have to also preach. We have to also go into very dangerous places sometimes. In the Soviet Union, for example, I have so much great respect for the Soviet devotees, the Russian devotees, because how many dozens and dozens of them were actually thrown into slave labor camps and charged with brainwashing and put in prison in these labor camps in Siberia and subjected to torture and so many other forms of abuse. Some of them died, as a matter of fact. So in those places, it's not like America, where we have so much legal protection of our freedom of speech and freedom of religion, although we've also had our challenges in the past ourselves. And certainly, just one little anecdote. I recently found a picture, Archanda knows about this, in 1975, Tridas and Adikeshava were indicted in New York City by a grand jury for brainwashing a devotee by mind control. Essentially, that theory was that we were brainwashing people by telling them from the Bhagavad Gita that if you don't become a devotee, you're nothing but a meat-eating karmic demon and you're going to come back as a worm in stool. That was one of our preaching, one of our what do they call it, PowerPoints or bullet points or talking points back in those days. Meat-eating karmic demons, worm in stool. We're a little radical back in those days, not so mature. But anyway, I was sent up to New York along with Balavanta Prabhu to work the media, so to speak, and we had a big press conference at the Warwick Hotel, and all the media was there, and it was something you see out of a movie where everybody's shouting questions and yelling and screaming, and I had the best time of my life, practically speaking. I had such a good time, which I won't go into, but I recently sent Tridas, who is in Europe someplace, France. I sent him that picture, and I said, "You remember this?" And he wrote me back, and he said, "Yeah, I remember. That was the first time I had ever been put in jail, and it wasn't a very pleasant experience." And when I saw that, I said, "Boy, he's really lived a sheltered life," because in my case, I had been arrested at least over a dozen times before and after I became a devotee. I mean, every time we went on Sankirtan and some of these southern cities, we got thrown in jail. Kamsa put Vasudevan Devaki in jail, another big demon. Was going to kill his own sister because he was so afraid of the child that she might produce. So I was thinking, boy, is he just, you know, jail is no big deal. Of course, I shouldn't say that because I'll probably go to jail for something else before this is all over. But I had a lot of my advice is just fast and chant and call the media and go on a hunger strike and you'll get out. Somehow or other, they'll let you out. But anyway, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and he was, when Prabhupada being in Vrindavan and our being in Vrindavan is not exactly the same thing. When Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, he was actually tasting, he was actually relishing the pastimes of Krishna and Radharani. He was actually experiencing those on a first-hand basis. He was immersed in those pastimes. And so what he says on the ship, of course, on the ship, he had two heart attacks, at least two heart attacks, and he was constantly seasick. And he thought he was going to die. He really thought he was going to die. He did not think he was going to survive the trip. But somehow or other, Krishna saved him. And the captain remarked to Prabhupada that he had never had such a calm voyage from India to America, that the seas, the Atlantic Ocean, or wherever way they went, was very calm. And Prabhupada said, "Yes, Krishna has taken control of the ship. Otherwise, I would have died on this voyage," because he was deathly, deathly sick, with no medical attention whatsoever. So his one of his entries on September 10th of 1965, he says that today the ship is plying very smoothly. I feel today better. What's that? Oh. But I am feeling separation from Sri Vrindavan and my lords, Sri Govinda, Gopinath, Radha Damodar. My only solace is Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, in which I am tasting the nectarine of Lord Chaitanya's Leela. I have left Bharatabhumi just to execute the order of Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in pursuance of Lord Chaitanya's order. I have no qualification, but have taken up the risk just to carry out the order of his divine grace. I depend fully on their mercy so far away from Vrindavan. Now, one thing to remember about these passages from Prabhupada's diary is that he's not giving a class. He's not in a darshan. It's not a morning walk. These are his innermost, confidential, intimate feelings between him and Krishna. And his, obviously, as he says, through the parampara, the disciplic succession. Prabhupada is not writing for an audience here. He's putting this in his diary, which was intended to be private and very personal. But in these passages from his diary and the poems that I'm going to read, our entire philosophy, the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, the entire Chaitanya Charitamrita, the entire Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, all of these things, every aspect of our philosophy, every component of our philosophy is contained in these passages from Prabhupada's diary. It's just astonishing how in these short poems, our whole philosophy, this universe, this ocean of philosophy, volumes and volumes and volumes of knowledge are contained in these poems. So in this one, Prabhupada is obviously talking about the disciplic succession and the instructions of his guru and his separation from Vrindavan, feeling this great separation. Now, on the ship later on I think a few days later, he wrote another poem. And there's a passage in this poem. I'll get to it. I'll read this. Because it also, Prabhupada is coming to America to preach. He's coming here to save us. And in this poem, in these two poems, we get a real understanding of what Prabhupada's sentiment, what his mood was, what his mission was, and how he was feeling. And it's quite astonishing if you really meditate on this and contemplate Prabhupada's words. So he says in this first poem, I think this was September 13th, 3 days after that previous passage from his diary. He says, I emphatically say to you, O brothers, you will obtain your good fortune from the Supreme Lord Krishna only when Srimati Radharani becomes pleased with you. Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is very dear to Lord Gauranga, the son of Mother Sachi, is unparalleled in his service to the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna. He is that great saintly spiritual master who bestows intense devotion to Krishna at different places throughout the world. By his strong desire, the holy name of Lord Gauranga will spread throughout all the countries of the Western world. In all the cities, towns, and villages on the earth, from all the oceans, seas, rivers, and streams, everyone will chant the holy name of Krishna. And Prabhupada is on the ship in the middle of the ocean on the verge of death, and he's predicting the mission of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya's mission will spread everywhere, to every inch, every corner, every nook and cranny of this planet. As the vast mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu conquers all directions, a flood of transcendental ecstasy will certainly cover the land. When all the sinful, miserable living entities become happy, the Vaishnava's desire is then fulfilled. Again, Prahlad Maharaj, when he was asked by Lord Nrisimhadev, what do you want? Ask for some benediction. He only asked that I want to deliver the conditioned souls, including his father. He did not ask anything for himself. He asked that the conditioned souls, people suffering in the cycle of birth, death, disease, and old age, would be delivered. Although my Guru Maharaj ordered me to accomplish this mission, I am not worthy or fit to do it. I am very fallen and insignificant. Therefore, O Lord, now I am begging for your mercy so that I may become worthy, for you are the wisest and most experienced of all. If you bestow your power by serving the spiritual master, one obtains the absolute truth. One's life becomes successful. If that service is obtained, then one becomes happy and gets your association due to good fortune. And then here's this where it ties into Prahlad Maharaj. He quotes from the Srimad Bhagavatam, a verse that we'll see in the next chapter. My dear Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, because of my association with material desires, one after another, I was gradually falling into a blind well full of snakes, following the general populace. But your servant, Narada Muni, kindly accepted me as his disciple and instructed me how to achieve this transcendental position. Therefore, my first duty is to serve him. How could I leave his service? O Lord Krishna, you are my eternal companion. Forgetting you, I have suffered the kicks of Maya birth after birth. If today the chance to meet you occurs again, Prabhupada thinking he could leave his body at any moment. So if today the chance to meet you occurs again, then I will surely be able to rejoin you. Then he says something that's really not included in all the versions of this poem. I think the editors left it out because when I went back into the appendix of the Lilamrita and looked at the actual full poem, this was there that I had never realized before. Maybe some of the scholars and more advanced devotees were aware of this one shloka. But Prabhupada says, O dear friend, in your company I will experience great joy once again. In the early morning I will wander about the coward pastures and fields. Running and frolicking in the many forests of Braja, I will roll on the ground in spiritual ecstasy. Oh, when will that day be mine? That's a pretty powerful shloka. Oh, dear friend. He's addressing Krishna. It's just him and Krishna in the cyclic succession on this boat in the middle of the ocean. In your company, I will experience great joy once again. Then afterwards, after that sentiment, he says, Today that remembrance of you came to me in a very nice way. Because I have a great longing to you, I am your eternal servant, and therefore I desire your association so much. O Lord Krishna, except for you, there is no other means of success. That's pretty heavy. Then after he got to Boston, the captain took him on a walk. He went on a walk with the captain in the city. And so Prabhupada got his first glimpse of Western civilization. And Boston is a pretty intense place, like all the cities are. But some cities on the East Coast, I think, are much more intense than the West Coast cities. L.A., you have to go on the freeway to really appreciate the intensity. You go downtown, it's kind of empty. But the cities on the East Coast, New York, Boston, Washington, they're like filled. So Prabhupada, after he went on this walk and he saw the task that was ahead of him. He saw what he had to accomplish. When he saw what he had to accomplish, he wrote another poem. And it just brought to mind, I had an experience myself, similar, not similar to this in the devotional sense, but I was in New York City in the early 80s, and I was working on the New York airport case, and I had a deposition in the World Trade Center. I was deposing one of the Port Authority, I think the manager of the New York, New Jersey Port Authority. And so it's New York, so you go up on this 58th floor or something, and you walk down the hall and you hear all this yelling and screaming from all these rooms where all these depositions are going on. Everybody's arguing, fighting with each other. It's New York. And so we went into this room, and the deposition went all day and was yelling and screaming, et cetera. So I came out at 5 o'clock, almost at 5 o'clock. I came out of that entrance of the World Trade Center that's right by Wall Street, and 5 o'clock rush hour, and there were like literally thousands and thousands of people coming out of their, pouring out of their offices, trying to get to the subways and the trains and everything else. And the taxis were coming, thousands of taxis going down the street. And not one pedestrian would skip a beat, and not one car would slow down. And they were just this mass of people frantically rushing at 5 o'clock. I thought I was going to be trampled to death. I came out and I went, I'm going to die right here. I'm going to get trampled by this mob. So when Prabhupada came and he saw Boston with all these people rushing around, it's like Rath Yatra in a sense. You go to Rath Yatra and you're in the middle of Rath Yatra, and all the chanting and the plays and the dancing and the prasadam and the deities. And then you leave and you hit the boardwalk, and all of a sudden there's all these characters out on the boardwalk with this rap music playing and all this other stuff, and they're doing all kinds of crazy things. And you get a little farther away, and the farther away you get from the Rath Yatra, the more the material energy just comes in and envelops you. You just become enveloped by this material energy. So it's like that. It's like after Prabhupada came from Vrindavan, where he was enveloped with Radha Krishna and Krishna's pastimes, and he came and he hits the United States and he goes on this walk in Boston. And he comes back and he writes this poem. And this is another amazing, again, all the qualities of the Paramahamsa. Someone on the platform higher than Bhava. I mean, where Prabhupada is at is just, I can't even begin to conceive of where he is. It's beyond anything that I can ever imagine. But he says, he comes back from this experience in the city, and he says, my dear Lord Krishna, you are so kind upon this useless soul, but I do not know why you have brought me here. Now you can do whatever you like with me. But I guess you have some business here. Otherwise, why would you bring me to this terrible place? Prabhupada referred to these cities as Ugrakarma, dungeon of the demons. Read the first canto. First volume, I just know it's in the old Brown book, the first volume of the old Brown books, and where Prabhupada talks about these dungeons of the demons and these cities and all this technological development. Most of the population here is covered by the material modes of ignorance of passion. Absorbed in material life, they think themselves very happy and satisfied, and therefore they have no taste for the transcendental message of Vasudeva. I do not know how they will be able to understand it. But Prabhupada answered that already to those reporters. If they will simply listen to him, then they will understand. And then Prabhupada tells us how they will understand. But I know your causeless mercy can make everything possible because you are the most expert mystic. How will they understand the mellows of devotional service? Oh, Lord, I am simply praying for your mercy so that I will be able to convince them about your message. All living entities have come under the control of the illusory energy by your will, and therefore, if you like, by your will, they can also be released from the clutches of illusion. And then Prabhupada says something here, and this is the reason We're all here today in this temple room right this moment. I wish that you may deliver them. Prabhupada says this to Krishna in his intimate privacy of the ship. I wish that you may deliver them. Just like Prahlad said to Lord Nrisimhadeva, I wish that you may deliver them. Therefore, if you so desire their deliverance, then only will they be able to understand your message. The words of Srimad Bhagavatam are your incarnation. And if a sober person repeatedly receives it with submissive oral reception, then he will be able to understand your message. And then he quotes a long passage from the Srimad Bhagavatam. I'll read it and then I'll finish up. It is said in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is the Paramatma in everyone's heart and the benefactor of the truthful devotee, cleanses desire for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who relishes his messages, which are in themselves virtuous when properly heard and chanted. By regularly hearing the Bhagavatam and rendering service unto the pure devotee, this is a famous purport and verse. Everyone should know this. All that is troublesome to the heart is practically destroyed. In loving service unto the glorious Lord, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. At the time loving service is established in the heart, the modes of passion and ignorance and lust and desire disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness and he becomes happy. Thus established in the mode of goodness, the man rejuvenated by loving service to the Lord gains liberation from material association and comes to know scientifically of the personality of Godhead. Thus the knots of the heart and all misgivings are cut to pieces. The chain of fruitive actions is terminated and one sees the self as master. He will become liberated from the influence of the modes of ignorance and passion, and thus all inauspicious things accumulated in the core of the heart will disappear. How will I make them understand this message of Krishna consciousness? I am very unfortunate, unqualified, and the most fallen. Therefore, I am seeking your benediction so that I can convince them, for I am powerless to do so on my own. Somehow or other, O Lord, you have brought me here to speak about you. Now, my Lord, it is up to you to make me a success or failure as you like. No attachment to the results, leaving the results totally up to Krishna. O spiritual master of all the worlds, I can simply repeat your message. So if you like, you can make my power of speaking suitable for their understanding. Only by your causeless mercy will my words become pure. I am sure that when this transcendental message penetrates their hearts, they will certainly feel engladdened and thus become liberated from all unhappy conditions of life. People think they're so happy. They think they're so happy when they make a certain amount of money or they buy a house in Beverly Hills or they're on TV or they're famous or they're beautiful and they can wear a nice bathing suit at the beach and during the summer and everybody takes their picture. They think this is the measure of success. I remember when I met Garga Muni, he was the first devotee I ever met. I remember one of the first things he ever said, he was a sannyasi at the time, he said, whenever I see a beautiful woman, and of course it goes conversely for women seeing a handsome or strong man, he said, I immediately look for an old woman. He said, oh yes, in a few years, that is going to be her. And that's how he would keep himself under control from not being, because when you're on a college campus preaching, it's a very, very heavy atmosphere. Having done college preaching for many years, there are many temptations there. And if one is not fixed up and understanding the philosophy, then one will not survive that environment. It's too alluring. So he says, oh, spiritual master of the worlds, I can simply repeat your message. Okay. Only by your causeless mercy will my words become pure. I am sure that when this transcendental message penetrates their hearts, they will become engladdened and thus liberated. Okay. Oh, Lord, I am just like a puppet in your hands. So if you have brought me here to dance, then make me dance. Make me dance. O Lord, make me dance as you like. Prabhupada says it three times, begging Krishna. I have no devotion, nor do I have any knowledge, but I have strong faith in the holy name of Krishna. I have been designated as Bhaktivedanta, and now, if you like, you can fulfill the real purport of Bhaktivedanta. Signed, your insignificant beggar, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Boston, September 18th, 1965. Oh, wait a minute. So in this short period of time, Prabhupada in his diary is revealing everything, everything there is to know, all knowledge, the summum bonum of everything, the absolute truth is contained in these two poems, all devotional sentiment that one can possibly have. So the whole idea is that Prahlad Maharaj ventured into this extremely dangerous situation, the same way that Srila Prabhupada came to this country, this dangerous place to preach on the instructions. And whenever somebody would say to Srila Prabhupada, oh, why have you come? What are you doing here? Are you trying to defeat all the religions? Do you want, Prabhupada would always go back to the same answer. I am here, I have come because this is what my spiritual master told me to do. I am simply trying to execute the instructions of my spiritual master. So Krishna says at the end of the Bhagavad Gita that one who goes out and preaches, the preacher of all the devotees who surrender to Krishna, the preacher is most dear of all to him. So we have to somehow, I don't know how it's possible in my case, I have no idea whatsoever how to even get a drop of this devotion and service attitude to Srila Prabhupada. It's just so beyond anything I can ever imagine, but here it is. So this portion of the Bhagavatam, the story of Prahlad Maharaj, all the dangers he's faced, it's not just a superhero. It's not just a, you know, Spider-Man or Superman or Batman or something like that. It's actually real and teaching us how we have to go also to so many dangerous places. Just like Drutakarma Prabhu, he's going into the most dangerous places. He's actually confronting the material scientists. If there's any demons on the planet, it's them. Prabhupada blames everything on them because they have created all this facility for sense gratification. Drutakarma is going into these places where he's faced with so many enemies. Now, you remember the one time in Gainesville, I told the story before and I'll stop, when this one Nobel Prize winner, George Wald, his name was George Wald, came to the University of Florida to speak. And he had won some Nobel Prize and he was talking about life, the Big Bang Theory, et cetera, et cetera. And some of us went to this gathering. There was thousands of students there. And we challenged him in our own innocent, ignorant way, simplistic way. And afterwards, we were just attacked from everybody. All these students just pounced on us and started just criticizing us and calling us names and arguing. It was just like the most vicious environment I'd ever, I was like astonished. And I was happy that, you know, oh, they take it seriously because they realize there's some truth in this philosophy, but they are the biggest of all enemies that have to be defeated. All right, so does anybody, Satyanarayan Prabhu, you have anything that you'd wish to contribute here? Savas Prabhu, Drutakarma, anybody? Yes. Well, his reign was 200-300 years B.C. And then after him, how many demonic rulers have historically come in the aftermath of that ruler?
I was referring to the idea that
I think that's something, a pattern that goes all the way back to the Bhagavatam, where you have all of these demons, all of these Hiranyakashipu, Ravana. This is something that goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So, yes, it's the same pattern. They want to control everything. In his case, it was China. He wanted to bring China together into one country. But in these demons, they wanted to control the entire universe, the lower planets, the middle planets, the higher planets. They would throw the demigods out and take over their kingdoms. So it's something that's, it's a disease that keeps going on over and over and over again. Yeah. Yes. Well, it wasn't that they were coming to Earth. It was like he was going up to there. I mean, the Bhagavatam does not take place only on the Earth planet. Many of these stories and pastimes and take place on other planets and other universes. Some of them take place in the spiritual world. The demigods go to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma goes to Lord Vishnu. In many cases, that's a pattern. When the demigods are disturbed by the demons, they usually go to Lord Brahma, who's in the highest planetary system within this material universe. And then he usually goes to Lord Vishnu, who's lying down in the ocean of milk or his palace or wherever he's at that time, and presents the issue to Lord Vishnu to come and give them the powers to defeat these enemies. And so Lord Nrisingadev appeared. I believe that, yes, that was on the Earth planet. I believe that Prahlad was on the Earth planet. But the pastimes, many of the pastimes, take place throughout the material world, not just on this Earth planet alone. No, he actually, as we learned earlier in the Bhagavatam, he actually performed very severe austerities to obtain those powers. He had the desire to conquer the demigods, to rule the universe. And he stood on one leg for thousands and thousands and thousands of years with his arms up in the air. There's a picture of it in the Bhagavatam. And the ants ate all the skin on his body till there was nothing left but bone. And then he developed so much power as a result of this austerity that he performed that the heat was emanating from the top of his head, and it was burning the entire universe up into the heavenly planets. All the demigods were feeling the heat that was emanating from Hiranyakashipu's body. And they then went to Lord Brahma and said, "The universal order is being disturbed. Please go to this Hiranyakashipu and pacify him, give him something to make him stop." So he actually underwent extremely unprecedented and something we could never, ever possibly emulate ourselves, austerities to obtain that power. And that's something you'll see, that in order to accomplish, to get some kind of power, you have to undergo very, very severe austerities in order to achieve it. If we're in a very powerful or prosperous position in this lifetime, it means that in previous lives we've done some kind of austerities or done something pious to get to that position. It's not just that someone is born with a silver spoon in their mouth. They've got that silver spoon in their mouth because of their things that they did in previous lifetimes. So these demons with the mentality that they wanted to conquer the entire world, the entire universe, they would perform incredibly austere austerities, severe austerities, in order to get that power. Okay, we'll stop here. I think time. Thank you.